Edwin, I got a surprise for you.
What? What? What is it, Craig? Oh, shit. That's right. I forgot my glasses.
Sometimes.
No.
You just got to say what the f***.
Wow. I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going to say that.
Finders keepers, Edwin.
No, I want those back. I want those back.
Finders keepers, baby.
Don't worry, Mark. Those are $18, by the way. You break them, you owe me $17.
I thought you were about to say something like, that's a $10,000 pair of sunglasses. I was going to be like, whoa, not, Edwin rolls deep. Welcome, Secret Movie Clubbers, to Secret Movie Club Podcast 21. Today, we're going to be talking about Monty Python's two of their greatest features, Monty Python and the Holy Grail and Monty Python and the Life of Brian. And then we're just going to have a free-flowing conversation on all the movies that Monty Python have influenced since they started on the BBC back in 1969. And there are tons of them, as well as sketch comedy movies or movies made by sketch comedy troupes and that kind of cinema and comedy. Weirdly, that might sound really niche, but it's actually a pretty big part of cinema, believe it or not. Who is with us today?
Hello, it's Daniel.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Connor.
Connor who?
Connor Lloyd Cruz. Hey, it's me. I'm on the podcast.
Hi, I'm a lumberjack, and I don't care.
Nice. And I'm Craig. I am the founder programmer of Secret Movie Club. Intros at the start. The biggest intro, it just happened, and you cannot write it this way. We literally cleared the titles officially 10 minutes before, 10 minutes before we launch. So thank you, everybody responsible for clearing those titles for us. So this is August 2020. And because we have clearly seen that we're not going to be going back to movie theaters for at least another month or two, we are doing a parking lot cinema series in partnership with Electric Dusk, who have been doing this for years. They have an amazing big screen. They got the radio hookup, and they also secured an amazing parking lot, the Sears parking lot in Glendale, California. And this weekend, August 7th, Friday, August 7th, we are going to do a John Hughes double feature of Ferris Bueller's Day Off and The Breakfast Club. And then Saturday, August 8th, we're going to do a John Hughes double feature of National Lampoon's Vacation and Weird Science. Both double features start at 8:15 sharp. So the gate opens, as it were, at 6:45 p.m. Everything, we're doing everything to be COVID, comply to the rules and regs of COVID safety. So you're going to pre-order everything, Secret Movie Clubbers, your tickets, your concessions. When you come to the gate, we're going to literally check you in ticketless, and we are going to have masks and gloves, and we're going to keep our distance other than handing you factory sealed pre-ordered concessions. And then you're going to stay in your car, and we'll explain the rest when you get there. There will be a 20-minute intermission between movies, and there will be restrooms, just so you know. And then we're just going to watch I love John Hughes, and the motivating factor for our parking lot cinema series, which we hope will run at least through Labor Day, is we just want to give everybody the movie summer 2020 that we should have had. So we are going to be programming every weekend. It'll be something different, a different theme, a different approach to it. It's not all going to be necessarily John Hughes movies, for instance. We are going to have some out-of-the-box programming. But for now, most days will be double features. So it's a double feature ticket. You get both movies and everybody you get in the car. When you go to purchase them, you'll see it. You pay a car fee, and that car fee also includes your first ticket. And then however many more people you have in your car, you pay a per person fee. And then that gets you both movies. And that's it. So just go to our Secret Movie Club Eventbrite or Secret Movie Club Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or our website, secretmovieclub.com, and you can get tickets now. And then other than that, up on all our social media channels, Connor Lloyd Cruz's Secret Movie Club Radio Hour 2 Diner is up and ready for download. Connor, you brought in a very concise and fleet 27-minute episode in which you have an entire murder mystery with an amazing Texas idiom. Because, Connor, where are you from in Texas?
I'm from the Houston area, so central, east, but I'm fascinated with West Texas. It's like an alien planet. West Texas is what people think of when they think of Texas. That's the desert and the cactuses and the tumbleweeds.
So you get a West Texas murder mystery at a diner. You can download that now. People are downloading it, too. It's already approaching one of our most downloaded. So congratulations. Then also, too, you can go and we have 20 podcasts and another Radio Hour episode. So we already have literally, I think, 24 hours of content for people, or roughly 24 hours of content. So if you're taking some cross-country trip, or I don't know, driving from Canada to Tierra del Fuego, we got you covered. And you can email us general questions at community@secretmovieclub.com, podcast and radio hour questions at podcast@secretmovieclub.com. Let's move on. So this Saturday, we watched two of Monty Python's, probably considered their two greatest features, although Monty Python and the Meaning of Life is pretty amazing. It's probably ridiculous to say that, but Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and then Monty Python and The Life of Brian. Monty Python was a British comedy troupe. They formed and they got a TV show. They all knew each other because they had mostly done David Frost's TV show before this, and David Frost's TV show, I learned, was a kind of daily show before there was the Daily Show in the 1960s, and most of the Pythons were on there doing comedy. They met, they pitched the BBC, and in 1969, they did Monty Python's Flying Circus, which was a sketch comedy show that ran for four seasons, and the six Pythons who made up the troupe would go on to make features through 1983. Their first feature was actually just reshooting sketches from Flying Circus. It was called And Now for Something Completely Different, and that was to break them into the American market. So it is technically their first feature, and there is a lot of visual innovation in it for sure, and there were buttons and interstitials that were just for the movie, but it is essentially their best sketches from their first two seasons. Their first real made-for-the-cinemas feature was Monty Python and the Holy Grail, made in 1975, and it's basically a riff on King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table and the Search for the Holy Grail, and it's the first of their movies where they would take an idea, King Arthur, and all the sketches would riff around that. And weirdly, I think it kind of brought out the best in them to have to riff around one unifying idea.
And Now for Something Completely Different was the first Monty Python I ever saw as a kid and was my first experience with that. I don't know why that has any relevance to things, but that's my basis of my introduction to them. Then I watched, I think I saw Holy Grail, and then I went into Flying Circus as a kid, because around that time, I think the US finally got like a DVD release of Flying Circus. It was like this really colorful giant box set.
You also, I feel like as a kid, you don't go into Life of Brian.
No, I had, to be honest, I had never seen Life of Brian until this weekend. I don't know why, because I've loved every other thing I've seen. I watched all of Flying Circus, blah, blah, blah. Well, I also, as a kid, was obsessed with Douglas Adams. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is maybe my favorite book. So I think the sensibility of that type of humor resonated in film form when I found Monty Python, and I sort of saw how they interconnected in terms of the British sensibility and the dry wit. And I mean, Holy Grail, there's like a point in middle school, at least in my generation, maybe Connor as well. I don't know, perhaps Edwin.
I imagine, Daniel. Part of the reason I didn't talk is because I imagine your story is going to be almost identical.
There's just like a point in middle school where I don't know how it happens, but everyone sees Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Every kid does.
At least like the kids who would be in friends groups with us.
Yeah, but then it spreads. It's like a virus, and it spreads. And all of a sudden, for like a month or two, the only jokes made in middle school are Holy Grail jokes. The Holy Grail is like this milestone movie of middle school, because it's both appropriate. You can kind of get by seeing it there, because all of like the violence and stuff is sort of over the top. But it's also pushing it a little bit if you're from a sort of sheltered family. It's kind of the one they're like, yeah, you can watch that. That's a funny movie. It's rated PG. And I vividly remember that.
Well, it's funny, weirdly, how their British sensibility smuggles the naughty stuff in.
Yeah, and I imagine, too, it's because the PG-13 rating didn't exist. But it does. It's one of those where, like, as a kid, the jokes that are for the adults go over your head. And then you rewatch it as an adult, and you're like, wow, yeah, you clever little devils.
I like this movie a lot. I mean, as a kid, I like, adored it. It was, like, you know, one of those movies that's, I think, because it is such a different sensibility than everything you're surrounded by, and it is so clever, and I think holds up pretty well. If anything doesn't hold up, it's only because I've seen it so many times, if that makes sense. Because at a certain point with comedy, I think when you lose that surprise, it starts to not be quite as funny. But yeah, I loved this movie as a kid. I actually got to see Bragg, but in the mid-2000s, I got to see Spamalot on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
Not with the original cast. I did not get to see Mr. Tim Curry. That would have been incredible. When he was doing it, you couldn't get tickets. I saw it like several years down the road. That's an impressive musical. Broadway musicals are cool. People should go see them when you can do it again.
The first time I saw the movie was during my high school years. Summer vacation. I spent my summers at my grandmother's house. And
like 3 years ago?
Shut up, Connor. I'm telling the story here, man. Like I say, I spent my summers at my grandmother's house, and my local theater there was showing Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And I never heard of that movie before. I only seen the trailer of it. I got interested. So I went, matinee price, went inside, saw it, laughed my ass off. I was so confused at the ending of the movie, but until I found out that was part of the joke, I just laughed my ass off. That was like one of the greatest screenings I ever went to. Even though it was not on 35, this is beyond my 35 world, but it was so great to see it on the big screen. I loved every single minute of that movie. My favorite segment is the John Cleese segment, Sir Lancelot, where he just goes into a castle, just kills everyone around them, thinks he's saving a princess, but is actually a dude. I love that segment so much. That's like the best segment in the whole movie. It's so great.
That running joke, I think, is one of my favorite jokes in the movie still.
That's hilarious. Like, they're like watching it.
I feel like the creators of Family Guy saw that and based their entire show on that one joke.
Got him.
After Holy Grail, I did see And Now Something Completely Different. But I liked it. It was okay. But I think I need to see the TV show first. I should have watched the TV show first and then see the movie.
Yeah, you know, I only saw And Now for Something Completely Different once years ago. And what I remember having seen The Flying Circuses is it's like you said, it's totally good, but it doesn't quite have the energy because they're just they're redoing the sketches. So they've already done them, so they have to redo them. And it's funny when you hear this, like when people have to re-record famous tracks, which sometimes happens, and they're just trying to imitate the original track. But it is interesting because the Flying Circus stuff is because it's them doing it the first time and they don't know if it's going to work. They don't know they're Monty Python yet. There's kind of an energy to the TV stuff versus something completely different.
Flying Circus was my first. It's like my favorite British comedy. My second is sort of Python related because it has John Cleese in it. Fawlty Towers.
Oh, totally that Python related.
It's golden comedy right there. I love every single f***ing episode in that show. It gets better and better and better. John Cleese is going outbursts of just madness in the hotel. Manuel just being Manuel. He's my favorite character, by the way. I don't care if he's like, you know, doing a Spanish accent, even though it's British. I don't care. He's hilarious. And just everybody in that show is just outright hilarious.
Well, let's have you talk about it a little bit when we get to Monty Python-influenced stuff, because Fawlty Towers is perfect. Fawlty Towers influenced The Office. I mean, Fawlty Towers influenced...
It did?
Oh, yeah. Huge.
Everything influenced everything.
That's true.
Like, every sperm is sacred.
Yeah. Monty Python, Meaning of Life. I would just say that I had kind of a funny experience. I think because we're trying to do so much with Secret Movie Club this weekend, I was tired. So I'm trying to take that into account also. But watching Monty Python and the Holy Grail, I totally still love it as a film. But Connor, what you said, I think that nothing replaces seeing that movie as a teenager for the first time. There's something about Holy Grail as kind of a gateway drug to adult comedy.
And then, like, showing it to friends and
totally.
Stuff.
Totally. I have seen Grail maybe, like, 5 to 7 times, I think. And so this time, I knew all the jokes. I was sort of watching it more as a filmmaker than I was watching it just as a comedian. And the bits that... it's funny. The bits that I like are probably, in some ways, the most... I don't know what you would call them, like backwards or like, I still love when Michael Palin goes to the castle with all the women and Carol Cleveland is just like, you're going to have to stay first the spankings and then the oral sex. And I remember as a kid, I was like, whoa, oral sex. and then when John Cleese comes and rescues him, I always remember being so bummed because I thought we were about to get a scene where Sir Galahad just hooked up with all those women. And I know that the joke is that he doesn't, but I was so bummed, and I was so bummed again watching it. I was like, oh no, leave him.
I wish this had become a hardcore porno.
Right, which of course it couldn't. Also, I guess the only other thing I would say is that in doing my research, I learned, and I should have known this, that the Monty Python movies play the way that Beatle albums play, which is that if you see a scene that stars Michael Palin, Palin probably wrote it. If you see a scene that stars Eric Idle, Idle probably wrote it. Not always, but if you see a scene with Palin and Jones, who were a writing team in Oxford, they probably wrote it. And then if you see a scene with Chapman and Cleese, they probably wrote it. And I didn't realize Graham Chapman and John Cleese are the backbones of Holy Grail and Life of Brian. And so the other scene that I always loved is I always loved the whole thing about how the British hate the French. So when they go to that castle and John Cleese is the Frenchman and the French are just totally ragging on the Brits. Like, I always found that hilarious. And I found out that that is a Chapman Cleese written sketch. And it's you can tell who wrote what.
There's a lot of like physical stuff that I found funnier this time, like small physical stuff where it's like just the way that like John Cleese was like looking around when the rabbit was coming,
right?
Like the way and I don't quite remember finding Tim's fireballs quite as funny as I did this time because it's so he's just showing off.
I think that's why I still love it. I do agree with you guys though that it's one of those things, it kind of feels like your favorite meal that you come back to it and it still tastes great, but it's sort of like you're used to it now, if that makes sense. It'll never replicate that first time. And especially with an audience, I feel like it's still successful, you know, watching it as a virtual screening. But man, with a packed theater, it's a different world.
Yeah, and it's funny. You guys are bringing up something. I don't even know what you say, because there are some comedies that I can watch again and again. Like we're going to do Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I can watch every year. Big Lebowski, I can watch every year. His Girl Friday, Howard Hawks comedies every year. I think one of the things about Holy Grail is that there are so many surprises in it, comedy-wise. Like when that historian just gets killed, I think the first time you see it, you're like, what? And there's just all this, and then you know it. So then the second time, or like the rabbit, that rabbit bit, I told this story over the weekend. I was 9 or 10, and when that rabbit started killing all the knights, I just fell over laughing, and I couldn't stop. And my sister and my dad just watched me. But then when you know what's going to happen, there's some like element of surprise comedy that I realized you can never recapture after you've seen the movie once.
Also, I was going to say, in terms of Edwin mentioned this with the ending, I saw this in the middle of the Lord of the Rings films coming out. And so I was very, very into Lord of the Rings. So I was 11 when the first one came out. And the ending, I thought we were going to get a Lord of the Rings style medieval battle. And then it stops. And as a kid, that infuriated me. I didn't think it was funny. I thought they ruined what was going to be the climactic action scene. And it pissed me off.
You know, it pissed me off,
and
too.
And I think about that every time it comes to the ending. Just what I wanted as a child.
That scene in general, it just, like, blew me away. Like, oh, my God, they're getting arrested. Like shut the camera. All right, and then boom. Nah, 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 like, I want them to fight the French. But they did it. They just get arrested.
As someone who likes short movies and usually doesn't like big battle sequences, I'm glad they're just like, we're out. We're done.
It's the perfect thing we've talked about many times on this. The constraints on their budget led to some of the funniest things. Like, they can't afford horses. They use the coconuts. Those are now iconic pieces of comedy history versus because they had to get creative to get around what was sort of holding them back.
Totally. That was what I was watching it with that. I was like, holy moly. And, you know, they only shot essentially the entire film in and around one Scottish castle. So every castle in the movie is basically the same castle from a different side or within the castle. And I was like, man, that was good filmmaking. Because I didn't notice the first time I saw it that all the castles were just one castle.
I think the other thing is, like, there's not a lot to talk about with it except for how it engaged you on a comedic level. Like, I don't know if there's a ton of themes going on. There's right. A lot of, like, conversation outside of, like, does this comedy work and did you find it funny? Which is sort of interesting as a dynamic because there's not, like, character growth. It's very centered around the sketch ideal as a movie, which I think some stuff, like a Saturday Night Live, sometimes their sketch to movie things don't work for me because of that, but somehow Monty Python's work does work in that regard, and I think it's because of the writing. So
it is interesting to watch Holy Grail for me because it was co-directed by Terry Jones and Terry Gilliam, two Pythons, and then actually no Monty Python movie after that was ever directed by Terry Gilliam because John Cleese specifically got so furious that Terry Gilliam was so obsessed with the visual, and Cleese kept saying, like, no, we got it. Where's the joke? Is the laugh there? And Terry Jones was more of, like, is the laugh there? But I actually think of the three features, even though Monty Python and the Meaning of Life has some pretty amazing visuals, Holy Grail probably visually is the most interesting, and I think it's because you have Gilliam kind of quality controlling the feeling of it.
I kind of agree. I think Life of Brian looks pretty good too. But I definitely think Holy Grail, it feels different than like a lot of what like a sketch movie would be, because I think it does look like a real movie.
Yeah, I agree with that too.
And that was the thing, is Gilliam was directing it as a real movie. And I think the Pythons, and you can see this in the next two movies, they wanted to make a great movie, but they were doing it as a sketch comedy troupe. Moving on to Monty Python and the Life of Brian, which was actually for me more of the revelation. I had only seen it once. I'd always loved it. So this was just my second time. Interestingly, when they were doing the publicity junket for Holy Grail, Eric Idle made a joke. Some journalist said, well, what's your next movie? And Eric Idle said, oh, we're doing Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory. And then all the other Pythons just burst out laughing. And after that press junket, they all were like, actually, Eric, that's a pretty good idea. So then they all sat down and they literally, the treatment was called Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory. And they were going to do that. But then they were like, they read the Gospels and they were like, actually, there's not really a lot you can make fun of Jesus about. They all found, even though not many of them are religious, in fact, most of them are anti-religious, I discovered they all agreed with Jesus. So they were like, we can't really do this because we all agree with what he said. So instead, they decided to make Monty Python and the Life of Brian, which would be about all the tangential things in the Gospels surrounding Jesus. And they would make fun of the Roman Empire. They'd make fun of religious zealots. They'd make fun of sort of anything dogmatic or zealous. And that was their idea. And then they riffed on that. And the plot of Monty Python and the Life of Brian, essentially, is Brian is born the same time as Jesus is in Nazareth. Basically, we see his life instead of Jesus's life. And Brian is one of the other prophets of that time. And there were many prophets, but he actually doesn't want to be a Messiah. He doesn't want to be a prophet. We really just see everybody around him wanting a prophet and making him a prophet against his will, which is kind of a really interesting idea. Needless to say, this is the most controversial of Monty Python movies by like a long shot. Even Meaning of Life, which has some controversial stuff, never got close to Life of Brian. People protested it. Basically, Life of Brian was the most protested film on religious grounds before Scorsese's Last Temptation of Christ, because they both approached the Gospels and the subject matter in a different way than people thought, a not respectful way. But anyway, enough of that. Let's go round the horn. Start with Daniel, because it was your first time. What did you think of Life of Brian?
I really dug it. This was one to go back, and I'd be curious if anyone else had a similar thing. I was not allowed to see it as a kid, because even like my parents knew what Holy Grail was, but like Life of Brian was considered like a no-no from growing up in the church because of that controversy. Though seeing it now, I do think it's interesting that it had that behind it, because it does avoid making fun of not the what is presented in the Bible, but instead making fun of, as you stated much more eloquently, everything that surrounded it, including like some of the hypocrisy of organized religion in regards to that era especially. And so in that, it doesn't feel like an attack on anyone's beliefs. It feels like an attack on the people that surround it and give those beliefs the bad name that we kind of associate now.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of wild, because I think an easier comedy or a lesser comedy would have just focused in on anything funny they can poke at in actual people studying religion, whereas they landed on that it's much funnier to move around that and see why the things around it that sort of block people or don't let people see out is a funnier and I think more effective thing to poke at.
I like Life of Brian a lot. I probably like Holy Grail more. This was only my second time seeing Life of Brian. I was also kind of sleepy, so
it was a long week.
It was a long week, and I didn't see this one as a kid, not because of the religious reasons. I mean, maybe that was it. I think I didn't see it either because, A, my parents just weren't aware of it, you know, as being like another Monty Python movie, or if it was for like content reasons, it was more the fact that this is a more adult film than Holy Grail. I mean, just alone like the nudity, but the language and even though I'd say some of the subject matter, but it's good. I had a chuckle or two.
Did you have Daniel and Connor, before we go on to Edwin, do you guys have a favorite part?
I mean, I think the ending song is genius.
Yeah.
That entire bit. And the haggling part, I don't know why. I think I just saw it at the exact perfect time of night, but the haggle bit where he's running from the Romans and he's haggling over the fake beard.
I kind of think because I kind of agree that like Chapman and Cleese are like this the big are like the funniest ones in Holy Grail. I think that Eric Idle and Michael Palin in this one, as all their secondary characters, like the Emperor guy with the
biggest dickus.
Yeah, with the
that's Pontius Pilate. I couldn't believe how much I laughed at that.
Yeah, me too. That was like a real light bulb for me about that was such a juvenile joke. But I kept losing it when he was like, my friend, Biggest Dickus.
Or I also really like Eric Idle's character, the other one who's getting crucified along with Brian, who's just like, he keeps just being like, hey, no, I'm going to go. No, yeah. I'm just kidding. I'm here to get crucified.
I have freedom. Yeah. No, okay. Also, the bit with the spaceship was so surprising that... I think that's when I knew I was in, where I was like, okay, yeah, they get it.
And it's also the bit you can tell the most. You're like, oh, Gilliam directed this.
Totally. That, it's so funny you say it, because when I saw it for the first time, the spaceship part was my favorite part. So it's that weird thing of, that's the part I've always remembered. And now the second time I saw other things, and I'll say a little bit about it. But that spaceship part to me, I think is the most genius moment of the movie, because they're making this point about... sort of religion on Earth, and then this totally like alien society and comes in and like everyone's haggling and killing each other and not really dealing with the reality of what could be like infinite alien civilizations and how that would impact our philosophy and theology. But I just love how it's played for jokes, how the aliens are Muppets and they just crash their ship and then they crash back.
I saw this movie when I was 17. This is like 3 years after I finished up Holy Grail. Life of Brian, like, wow, that's like the most insane movie I've ever seen. And for me, I'm not a religious person. For this movie, this is great because they're poking fun out of it, but not necessarily towards Jesus Christ, just towards like the other bits and parts of his world, like the other people in it. I saw this like so many times. I fall asleep watching this movie. It's like my night movie to watch.
Life of Brian?
Yeah. Every time I watch a movie, I fall asleep to it. That's my night movie. And Life of Brian is basically my night movie. I was watching the behind the scenes features on the movie, and I was so astonished how one little thing can piss off an entire world. And this is a cool segment because EMI Films was financing the movie until the dude who owned the company read the script, called it blasphemous, basically pulled out halfway through filming, and then da 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 da. Guess who came in to save the day? George Harrison, man, the Beatles. And that's when we got Handmade Films, a company just to finance Monty Python, Life of Brian. And then from there on...
That was a solid impression.
Yeah.
I don't like to jinx it. I just wait for it to happen. But you've still given us an impression, I think, almost every podcast.
Hey, it's George Harrison. I created Handmade Films. I produced several films throughout all to the 90s. Yeah, I don't know what
he's
I did.
He's going Scottish.
And Eric Idle made a joke for him, like saying, "Oh, because he made a joke towards George, saying this is gonna be like the most expensive ticket that you ever bought, because he put in everything into the movie. He sold his office, he sold most of his stuff, his house, just to get this movie made." And that's cool. That's very cool that George Harrison got to do that.
Yeah, and the weird thing is, just like to piggyback on that, I was hearing that, so when Life of Brian came to the United States, there were massive protests, but that publicity, Life of Brian was made, I think, for like $8 million. I don't know if that's correct, but like somewhere between $6 to $8 million in 1979 dollars. But it grossed in the U.S. alone $20 million. So weirdly, all the controversy just helped it. It actually was a huge hit. This time, I actually was really impressed with all the satire that was going on that it really got me to think, like all the political groups. There was that great bit of satire that there's the People's Front of Judea and their enemies are the Judean People's Front. And they're like, so clearly they both are like fighting for the same cause, but because their names are different, they're against each other. And I actually thought Python was poking fun at everybody, because the political activism that they were making fun of could just as easily be directed at people who say that they're activists but don't do anything.
I was going to say, it reminds me of how modern day leftists online can't are way better at getting mad at each other than totally. Doing anything.
And I think the movie was pointing that out, was that these people were just fighting each other. They weren't like getting anything done against the real oppressor, which was the Roman Empire. And there was that great scene, too, where they don't even leave the table. They're just trying to vote on whether they're going to leave the table. But the ending, I actually found it funny, but devastating when Brian is up there on the cross and time again, someone comes to help him, but they don't help him. So he's just up there on the cross and like the Eric Idle claims to be Brian. And then his girlfriend just says, thank you. And then the Suicide Squad comes, but they kill themselves. And there was just something very Python about, look how absurd and ridiculous. None of these people are like actually dealing with the issue. And Python has said that Life of Brian is their personal favorite. They all had a great time making it. They were all loose. They were all getting along with each other. And I do think, Daniel, like what you were saying, whereas Holy Grail is just like this great, I don't know what you would even call it, just all these things they're playing around with comedy. I think Life of Brian has a point. And when you go through it, you definitely at the end are thinking. The fascinating thing about Monty Python, really more, I think, than any other sketch comedy show, except Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows, and I'll say why in just a moment. Monty Python directly influenced Saturday Night Live. Lorne Michaels has said that Saturday Night Live was essentially sort of a reconfiguration of his own experience in Monty Python's Flying Circus. And from that, I mean, think about how many SNL movies we got. So Monty Python influenced SNL. Of course, all the Pythons went on to do their own movies. John Cleese did Fish Called Wanda. Terry Gilliam is a huge film director. Probably the biggest movie guy to come out of Python is Terry Gilliam. Even all the way up to present day, Kids in the Hall, The State, which then branched off into Stella and Reno 911, and then Lonely Island, they all cite Monty Python. And then they would go on to do movies like Wet Hot American Summer or Thomas Lennon. Is that his name?
Yeah, Thomas
Lennon has written like the Harold and Kumar movies.
Who is related to John Lennon?
Oh, wow. There's all this Python influenced stuff after Python. And the only thing I'll say, we're not going to talk about Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows unless someone wants to. But out of Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows came Carl Reiner, Mel Brooks, and Woody Allen. And you really have to talk about Mel Brooks movies and Woody Allen movies and Carl Reiner movies. But that's a whole conversation for another time. So Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows definitely bears a lot of cinematic it influenced. But anyway,
I'll just continue from what you were talking about. I love The State. I specifically love Stella. I saw the Comedy Central show when I was in high school, or 14, 15, so whenever it came out. It was like mid-2000s. The State is a sketch comedy group that started in New York, and Stella is three of the guys by their own designation. They got together because they're the Jewish ones. they started doing a comedy show, like a live comedy show, Stella, and they turned it into this sitcom that I think is, there's only 10 episodes of it. It's Michael Showalter, Michael Ian Black, and David Wayne, who David Wayne is probably the biggest of the directors who's come out of there. And they also did, he directed Wet Hot American Summer, which is probably like my favorite, just like pure comedy. Yeah, those guys are great. Huge influence on my own sense of humor. And I'll let me recommend two sketches from The State that I just have written down. My two favorite.
I love The State.
Have you seen, do you know Taco Mail, that one?
A lot of it's faded from my mind.
Taco Mail's the one where it's mostly Kevin Allison and Michael Ian Black, and Kevin Allison is a mailman who's delivering tacos instead of the mail, and the whole thing is Michael Ian Black being like, listen, we love the tacos, but I need my bills. Just like, and it's just having this very calm, reasonable conversation with him. And then my other favorite, which was like a film in front of a studio thing, was Sideways House Family, which is a sitcom.
I remember,
where the house is sideways, and it's played like everything outside of the family is played really goofy. Like there's a goofy neighbor, but the family is like devastated because they can't afford like a better house. And one of the kids died from falling from the bathroom. and so it's just them being devastated.
There was so much talent in this state. I mean, I don't really know how they all knew each other. Do you know how they all knew? Cause that was a huge trip.
NYU.
Huh? They were all Tisch.
Yeah. They all went to Tisch. They were all, they got together and they created, just The State was those 11 11 people.
Wow. Yeah, that's just a ridiculous embarrassment of riches, the state. Other folks, my favorite Monty Python-influenced cinema.
I don't know if this is a direct influence, but it's produced by George Harrison. It was originally supposed to be John Cleese. It's a movie called Water. Water? You ever heard of that movie?
I think, you know what? Not that I'm the rule, the arbitrator of rules. I'm not good, but I wanted to say, I think I will allow it. Because Water does have a bit of a Python comedic sensibility. That's the Mike Caine movie.
Yeah, Michael Caine. So originally it was supposed to be John Cleese. If it would have cast John Cleese, it would have been like so much like a Python movie. But it still works. It still feels like somewhat of a Python movie. Just Michael Caine is a governor on an island. He's also a stoner, which is also cool.
That's what I remember, is he's growing pot all around his house.
Yeah, it's like one of my favorite movies of Michael Caine, because it's hilarious, and it's on the Criterion Channel if anyone wants to watch it. It's that one, and of course, as I said before, Fawlty Towers, again, the greatest British comedy show, right next to Flying Circus.
Oh, I think that's a great call, because handmade films would have never existed without Life of Brian. So anything made by handmade films, you can credit to Monty Python.
Exactly.
Yeah, With Nail and I, Mona Lisa. Handmade films did a ton of great stuff.
They did a lot. They produced like every movie every single year. And I actually bench watch all of them on the Criterion Channel. Most of their movies are on the Criterion Channel.
My favorite of the Monty Python influence thing is The Mighty Boosh. Which
That's
is
a great call.
British sketch show. It's sort of like it's definitely leads more in like the surrealist capacity. But I found an interview from them from years ago that talks about sort of their comedy and how it relates to Monty Python. And they said that there's three scenarios that make comedy brilliance, and it's witty banter, fantastical scenarios, and the coconut concept. They were told when they were getting their show on Channel 4 in the UK, that part of the success of Monty Python is you have to create visuals and things people would remember and would stick with them. And part of that was the coconut. And they said they just took that to heart as they made the entire show. And I think that's why it works so well. And as a side note, one of the directors and writers on The Mighty Boosh, a man named Paul King, would go on to make two films of Paddington and Paddington 2.
Oh.
Which I think says a lot.
So thank you, Monty Python, for Paddington 2.
Yeah, I think we have to really go back and thank that. In terms of the Mighty Boosh, in terms of stuff, there's I think the one sketch from the Mighty Boosh that is maybe universally known, whether you've watched it or not, is the Old Greg sketch, which is a fisherman who pulls this sea creature out of a boat named Old Greg, and it is a musical, sort of almost horror, wild, probably problematic in today's world. But it's sort of the thing, I feel like it went really viral at the start of YouTube and is kind of the de facto Mighty Boosh moment among many great ones.
I will point out, I am actually a big fan of John Cleese's Fish Called Wanda. Now, I mean, I love Gilliam and we can talk about all that, but
I think that's its own episode.
Yeah, totally. You know, for people who haven't seen A Fish Called Wanda, it's one of those comedies that at the time was huge. I don't even know that any of you were born. I saw it when I was like 10 or 11. It came out in 88, I think. 87, 88.
87.
And my dad took my sister and I, as my dad often did after the divorce, to see R-rated movies. I think kind of to stick it to my mom so that we'd come home on like Sunday night and be like, we just saw Fish Called Wanda. And my mom would be like, what? And I'd be like, yeah, John Cleese was naked with Jamie Lee Curtis. And then Kevin Kline was smelling his armpits. And then Michael Palin was killing all these dogs. My mom would be like, oh. But the thing I would say that, and Edwin, I'm going to weave this into what you said about Fawlty Towers. I do love all the Pythons, and I think they all bring their own thing. I think Python is like great communal collaborative stuff. It is bigger than the sum of its parts, because all those guys on their own, their stuff is interesting, but it's not quite what it is when they're all together bouncing off each other, which John Cleese said was the secret of their success, was how different they were. And it was like they would all not really get along comedically, but then they would bounce off and come up with these really wacko ideas. But I've always liked that Cleese, of all of them, was the writer. He was really a writer, writer, writer. He hated to ad lib. He would like, literally, he was like the Coen brothers. A Cleese sketch had to be performed exactly as it was written, because all the humor was in the pauses, the beats, and the wording. You couldn't really get the general idea and make it funny. Like the Dead Parrot sketch is a Cleese Chapman sketch because of how it is worded. And so when you watch Fawlty Towers, Cleese loves farce. And I'm kind of obsessed with farce as well. And farce comedy is where, you know, you set all these things into motion and then they go wildly out of control. I think Fawlty Towers and Fish Called Wanda is Cleese at his best, and the writing and the farce and how it builds to this third act, no one could do that like Cleese. And I do really study those for the kinds of comedies. I don't think I'd want to make farces, because in a way farces aren't as serious as comedies. Like a farce kind of goes off the rails, and I don't know that I want to get that broad, but I do love that Cleese could do it. And if people see A Fish Called Wanda, it's just he's a kind of a stuffy lawyer, and he falls in with this gang of thieves that has Michael Palin, Kevin Kline, Jamie Lee Curtis. He falls in love with Jamie Lee Curtis, and Kevin Kline is like one of his best roles, and Michael Palin has a great running bit where he's trying to kill an old woman who I think has witnessed the crime, but every time he tries to kill her, he just ends up killing one of her dogs, and she has like 12 dogs, and he feels awful about killing the dogs. He doesn't want to kill the dogs at all. He just wants to kill the woman. So it's like perfect Cleese-esque inversion, where it's horrible that he wants to kill the woman, but he feels awful about killing the dog. So anyway, Fish Called Wanda, it's a great farce. Check it out.
I was going to say, I think my favorite actual single sketch of all time, or maybe not even favorite, what I think is the best one of all time, is Mr. Show, the pre-taped call-in show, which I'm pretty sure was written by Bob Odenkirk, and it's David Cross in it. If you haven't seen it, I don't want to necessarily spoil the things that happen in it, but it's incredible.
What is it again? The pre-recorded call-in show?
Pre-taped call-in show. The general premise, I won't say where it builds to, but the general premise is that they're filming a pre-taped call-in show, so the previous week's show is playing while they're trying to record, so people keep calling in about the previous week's topic. And as it goes on, you kind of realize that this has been a recurring problem and that it's gotten worse and worse and worse.
There's just a whole wealth of great sketch comedy. And, based on Daniel's recommendation, I saw Palm Springs, which I think is its own filmmakers, but definitely it's got Andy Samberg and produced by the Lonely Island guys. And Palm Springs, people should see. I agree with you, Daniel. I actually would be willing to see it again. I thought it was that funny.
It's so pleasant.
It is. It is. It really is kind of like comfort food.
And sad.
I'm going to go to Super 8 today, drop off my 8mm film, and then it'll be up on my Instagram, _crazymovielover1985.
That's Edwin, right? Shot a Super 8 movie, yo.
Yeah, I made a film, y'all. I'm a filmmaker now. I'm going to be bigger than
Quentin. You've passed your quotient of swearing.
I'm glad. I was wondering when they were going to make a sequel to that movie. Last week I talked about how I finished watching all of Del Toro's films. I decided I'm getting back into watching movies more than I had recently. But I want to keep gamifying it because it gives me more of an incentive. So I'm going to try to finish off other directors that I love. And so I'm going through Spielberg. I had 15 films of his to see. I saw what? 4 of them. He's made 33 films.
You're gonna go through all his movies?
Well, I've seen 18, and now I've seen 22, so I only got 11 left.
What were the 4 you saw?
I saw The Terminal, which was cute. It was fine.
Hey, I just saw it the other night.
That could have been a really good movie if they had focused less on Catherine Zeta-Jones and actually focused on the reality of that kind of situation.
Yes, I agree.
Because
with you.
The parts that are about him and his community and like his home life are pretty solid. I saw War Horse, which was better than I thought it was going to be. It was fine. It was about a war, horse and war. The two ones that I'm more interested in talking about, one, I feel like we should do an episode on this and another of his movies, is Munich. I feel like we should do an episode on Munich and War of the Worlds one day, because those both came out the same year, and boy, was Steven mad about the Iraq War.
You just mentioned he made an unofficial 9/11 trilogy. Terminal is part of that.
Yeah.
And the Munich, War of the Worlds, and Terminal are all part of a 9/11 trilogy.
Yeah. And unlike Terminal, War of the Worlds and Munich are nasty films. Like, those are the, you know what I mean? Like, they're the meanest spirited films he's ever made, I feel like.
The sequence in Munich, and I love Munich, the sequence in Munich where they kill the female assassin. Like, I couldn't believe that Spielberg had directed that. Even though I think it was totally Spielberg, I was like, whoa.
Yeah, I like Munich quite a bit, too. It's a new favorite. Not top 5, but maybe top 10.
You know, I always sometimes play around with the idea. I would never do this, but like a fan editing certain Spielberg things. And like with Munich, I literally would take out like 15 minutes of the New York thing at the end. I don't think you need the love making sequence. I think we got it. I just kind of like
goofy.
Totally. I just be like, okay, he's in New York, and then Jeffrey Rush comes, and then the scene at the end.
Yeah, I think that last shot hammers it into your head enough when it's just like the Twin Towers center frame over the credits.
If we ever do a Munich, if we ever talk about Munich on the podcast, I'll have to retell this. But one time as a middle schooler, I was at a buddy's house for a sleepover playing video games. And his mom was like, I rented all these movies and Munich had just come out on DVD. And I was like, oh, I'd like to see that. I will watch it with you. And in a room, like there's sort of like a living room and then like an off room that everyone was playing like Halo in. And me and my friend's mom watched Munich, and Munich's specifically that sex scene is very loud. And I just, I vividly remember tensing up, looking over and seeing all of my friends looking back at me from the other room as I sit, you know, 2 feet from my friend's mom on their couch watching this very graphic scene.
But we should do an episode on Munich and War of the Worlds. Also, I saw the other one. I saw 1941, which this is your. I knew you were going to have that take, Edwin, and it's your worst. That movie sucks. It's so bad. It's two and a half hours of people yelling.
What's wrong with that? That's like comedy gold right there. That's like
that's how Edwin understands the world, Connor.
It's deeply exactly. Unfunny.
The score is amazing. Some of the actions are amazing.
The score is good, even though it's obviously John Williams playing around with stuff he uses in better later scores.
You're missing, Connor. You're blind. Yeah. You're blind.
What am I missing? I watched it. I looked like I was sitting. Hey, I looked like I was sitting at the DMV the whole time.
We did a Secret Movie Club Jury, which we haven't done officially. We were going to do it, and then COVID hit. But what Secret Movie Club Jury was when it was just my friends, and this was an idea of my friend Joe Ballerina. I want to be real clear. Joe came up with this idea. Was we would show a movie, and then we'd debate it. And it'd have to be a movie that was really divisive. So the first one we did was 1941. And Joe and I just flipped for who was going to take what side, because we're both huge Spielberg fans. And I ended up getting the easier side, which is that it doesn't work. And Joe had the side that it does work. And my big thing about it was that it's a beautiful movie to look at, but it doesn't work as a comedy.
No, the comedy direction is really bad. Like, yeah. I feel like Spielberg is good at having comedy in the background of other things. But when he's just trying to do goofy comedy, there's maybe like 5 minutes of stuff that works as being funny. But the rest of it, and there's a lot of ideas that could be funny. There's a lot of ideas that I don't know what they were thinking, like the John Candy stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's like racist, straight up racist.
Yeah, that stuff sucks. And the entirety of John Belushi's bit is that he makes faces and falls down. Dan Aykroyd's kind of okay in a couple of moments. And I did laugh quite a lot thinking of how expensive and how much of a waste of money it was.
There are a few jokes. I actually think Toshiro Mifune has one of the funniest lines, where they have Slim Pickens on the toilet and he walks into the foreground and he's like, "This is not honorable." When they're trying. But I agree that the big point I made that in that movie Jury was like a comedy has to be like a bag of popcorn where you hear the kernels popping like 4 or 5 every minute. And if they're not popping, then you're like, oh, what's wrong with the bag of popcorn? And there's like maybe kind of a chuckle every 8 minutes in that movie.
Yeah.
It just is not visually, it's amazing. Comedically, it doesn't work.
You're lucky, Karen, I don't show the DVD in your face right now.
Yeah, we heard all the DVDs fall.
That's such a knock them over.
I mean, you are the underdog in this situation, Edwin. Nobody... I think that most people would side with me.
Yeah, including Edwin, and I don't mean this as a punk, but including Steven Spielberg, who himself has gone on the record that the movie looks great and he's proud of it, but he said he messed up because it's not funny.
Yeah, it's my new least favorite Spielberg
movie. Have you seen Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull?
That's my fourth least favorite.
What? What's above, what's
below?
3 and 2.
Well, 1941.
Yeah.
For one, because I was just miserable the whole time. Ready Player One.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I hated it. Honestly, Hook.
Yeah, Hook's down there for me. Hook's at the bottom.
I'll just breeze through mine. I had a flip. I'm on the opposite thing. I have like put off TV for the last few years, and I've had a roundabout on TV and the 3 TV show. Well, I finished Watchmen. To start, Connor's been championing Watchmen, as he should. It's a masterpiece.
Trent got his Emmy nominations. He got 2. Trent Reznor is this close to EGOTing. He's got half of it. I'm so excited.
Can I recommend that enough? And then I started, there's three shows I'm doing simultaneously, kind of one episode or two a night. And that is I'll Be Gone in the Dark on HBO, which is the Golden State Killer documentary. Don't watch that before bed. You will feel awful. I May Destroy You, which is another HBO drama about a woman who is assaulted and is basically kind of looking back on her life. She tries to rebuild it after that. And it's a strange, like, comedy drama blend, and it's very powerful, and also it's really great. The less you know, the better. And finally, the new Perry Mason show.
Dude, you are the fourth person incredible. To say this. Yeah, my mom and my sister are like, get on Perry Mason.
Firstly, it's shot like a noir, but it's in color, but it has the way it's lit has super overexposed, the way it uses light through windows, and I think it's beautiful, but it's this very slow burn classic detective story, and it doesn't try and be meta about it. It is a take it as it comes, collect the evidence with Perry. You don't feel dumb, but you don't get spoon-fed things. At least that's been my experience in the first few episodes, and I am very in. It's also very graphic. If you are at all susceptible to violent imagery, some of the murders things that you see the aftermath of are like shocking. But it focuses in on him as a character and sort of his background coming out of the first war, World War One, and all that jazz. So it's all three of those things I recommended will not make you feel great, but are great, great storytelling.
But also, I'd like to plug, I stream at twitch.tv/ConnorCruz. Go there to see when I do it.
And watch 1941.
Sure.
I will say this, actually, and we'll, when we talk about Spielberg again, we can come back to it. Edwin, I actually have seen 1941 three or four times, and I'll see it again. I think it's an incredibly made movie. I actually get a lot out of it because it's still Spielberg's first phase. 1941 is the last movie of his first phase, and there's still that dual Jaws, Close Encounters type Spielberg filmmaking in it. So I watch it for that. So I'm ambivalent on it. I'm not a hater, but I am ambivalent. It doesn't work as a comedy. Anyway, I'll stop there. So my pop culture final thoughts. Connor, I finished Super, so now I got to get to Falling Down for Edwin. But I will say this. I liked it. I didn't love it. I'm going to give you the skinny. I appreciated how it was intentionally trying to be wrong in so many ways. And I like that. I found some of the envelope pushing, it worked. And some of the envelope pushing felt like trauma stuff that maybe doesn't work for me quite as much.
Yeah.
I definitely loved all the performances. I loved how gonzo Ellen Page was.
Yeah. Yeah, she's great.
Everything you said about it. I really like Kevin Bacon. He was funny. And people should see it. You should totally see Super. What I respected probably the most about it was just how crazy and daring the tone was.
Yeah.
Because it is like super violent. And the whole time you're like, I think I'm watching a psychopath. It's like Taxi Driver.
You can feel Gunn's trauma roots there. Though you can also, I think, in some ways feel him transitioning to like Guardians. It is kind of wild and unimaginable to think that this was the movie he made before Guardians. So in essence, he kind of got hired off of this movie, maybe.
That was what I was thinking, because I was like, on some hands, I get it, where Marvel's like, oh, he's a voice. He is a unique voice. Guardians of the Galaxy is one of my favorite Marvels. But anyway, I don't want to ramble. I just want to say that, yeah, I had some issues. I thought actually it was shot in kind of a flat, mundane way for me, but maybe they just didn't have any money. But I thought the performances, the emotion, and how envelope pushing it was, people should see it for that.
But be content warning. There's some nasty stuff in this movie.
And now I'm watching The Lighthouse, which I'm almost done with, so I'll talk about that. And then I'm going to watch Falling Down. So, guys, thank you very much. Let's wrap this podcast up. Secret Movie Club audience, just remember this Friday and Saturday, we are starting our parking lot cinema series. Friday, we're doing a John Hughes double feature, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Breakfast Club. Saturday, we're doing a John Hughes double feature of National Lampoon's Vacation and Weird Science. You can get tickets now. Well, you're going to hear this on Friday, so hopefully there'll be tickets left. If there are, please go. We have to cap it at 100 cars. We're really making sure that everybody has a good viewpoint in that the first weekend is great. So once we hit 100 cars, we cannot oversell that. So if there are tickets left, grab them. The parking lot is elevated, very safe. It's in Glendale, California. And if you have any questions, you can always write us at community@podcast.com or podcast at community@secretmovieclub.com. And Sorry, guys. I'm tired. You can write us at community@secretmovieclub.com, podcast@secretmovieclub.com. And that's it. We're August 2020. Let's just grind this out. Let's bring the whole world back to health and out of this craziness. And guys, it was great to have you on. Edwin, you got a question. Make it quick.
Let's end this with a musical, man.
Let's do it.
Go ahead, Edwin. You start.
You start. I'll add a verse, and that's our goodbye.
Okay, go for it.
Always look on the bright side of life.
We just got a copyright flag.
Always look on the bright side. What? Is that what it says? Damn it!
And don't watch 1941.
And we can go straight
thank you, everyone.
Down.
Have a great
all
weekend.
All right, there you go. As it descends into chaos, everybody watch great movies and have a great week. Bye, guys. See you soon.
Bye. Bye.
Don't do it.
Oh, Edwin, you're always doing this to me. Enjoy that chicken nugget, but then no more. Actually, you know what? Chicken nuggets don't crunch. Enjoy your nuggets. I'm not going to be a dictator about that. Yeah. Just don't, Edwin, don't talk with your mouth full. That will drive me nuts.
I'm respectful, Craig.
Thank
you. Don't do a sound sin.
That's your sound sin.
We're going to send you to audio jail.
You send me to audio jail, I'll break out like McQueen, Clint Eastwood, and Tim Robbins from Shawshank Redemption.
Steve McQueen and Clint Eastwood and Tim Robbins were all sent to audio jail?
They escaped, didn't they?
I guess.